Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I am, of course, Brett King, your host, and my co-host today is my good pal, JP Nichols. He's the host of Serial Entrepreneur, a Provoke FM podcast. He's the managing director of Fintech Forge and a retired World Cup goalkeeper champion.
Okay, I wish.
That last bit I made up, but JP, welcome back.
Oh, thanks.
You should be saying welcome back to me, actually, right?
Yes, welcome back to you. You are back in the country, but not for long, right?
I'm leaving again. I'm leaving for Thailand on Sunday for a well-earned vacation. I will be doing some of the shows from there, but top secret, but I'm starting to write my next book. Bank 4.0 is not yet out, and I'm already working on the follow-up. So, which is actually going to be a sequel to Augmented, but we can talk about that on another show.
But relentless and prolific.
Absolutely. So, today's show is brought to you by the Digital Banking Report. Digital Banking Report and our friends at Source Media. So obviously you guys know we partner a lot with these guys. Our friends at Source Media, they're a growing digital business, a performance media company, financial technology, healthcare sectors. Their brands include American Banker, Payment Source, The Bond Buyer, Financial Planning, Accounting Today, Mergers and Acquisitions, National Mortgage News, Employee Benefit News, and Health Data Management. But as you may know, Breaking Banks is syndicated on American Banks also, so you can check it out there at americanbanker.com. Also follow their Twitter feed, Amer Banker, A-M-E-R, Banker, on Twitter. And those guys are very kind to us, lend us the studio when we're in New York, so we're very grateful for that, and are an excellent partner for us. Coming up, what have we got in terms of conference announcements coming up, JP?
Well, we're in the kind of the summer doldrums here, but things, of course, will be picking up before too long. And August 9th in Chicago is Block Legal. That's the premier legal conference for blockchain and crypto. More on that is available at fintechs.org. That's T-E-X. In the about 10 days later, August 19th in Toronto is Fintech Day. Check it out at fintechcanada.com.
And we have Finovate 4 coming up in New York City, and that's September 24th to 27th. We're hosting Breaking Banks is going to be there. We're hosting a Power Hour session. JP is going to be there, myself, and our Breaking Banks regular, Jim Marus. 4 p.m. on the main stage, September 22nd. How did I do with pronunciation that time, JP?
Hey, you finally got it right, Jim. You can thank me for that one.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. And then October 9/11 is BAI Beacon. JP, you want to cover that one off?
Oh, sure. I'm excited for this. You know, BAI Beacon is the financial services conference is designed to take industry goals and challenges and break them down into actionable steps that are right for your organization, your team, and you. So both Jason Henricks, host of Fintech 5 and co-host of Breaking Banks, he and I will both be there as our Fintech Forge group puts on a rare public version of the popular innovation workshop that we've done. And I will also be serving as host and moderator of the BAI Global Innovation Awards. And those are available for public vote now. So more information at BAI.org.
And October 22nd to 25th is, of course, Cybos time. So Swift and the InnerTribe team this year are heading down under to Sydney, down under. For the big event, and Breaking Banks is going to be there. We're actually going to have a pod, Breaking Banks pod at Cybos at the InnerTribe Arena, and we hope you'll join us. Come and say hi, and maybe you'll get your face on the radio. Well, not your face, your voice at least. But
well, if you have something you want to share with our audience, hit us up on Twitter at Breaking Banks 1, or you can email us at info@provoke.fm. Well, Brett, a few things in the news. I know you've got a couple of things to talk about, and I saw a couple of things that caught my eye. But first, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, but it's worth giving another quick shout out to our friend and sponsor of the show, Avoca. They won Red Herring's Top 100 Award for North American Startups. If you haven't listened to Brett's interview with Avoca's Derek Corcoran, you can find that also at provoke.fm. But did you see Citizens Bank now is also launching their own standalone digital bank? This is starting to become a new trend. Last month, JP Morgan Chase rolled out its millennial targeting mobile only banking offshoot they call Finn, while Santander, Standard Charter, and UniCredit have all made similar moves. And this actually harkens back to our friend Michal Panovitz, who pulled this at MBank in Poland several years ago now. This idea of kind of competing with themselves with launching their own digital competitor brands. What do you think of that move, Brett?
Well, I think it's fairly predictable. You know, the economics are changing, and I think, you know, it's much harder to move the big ship and change the entire existing bank than launch something to the side with sort of that different economic model and a different tech stack. So I think we're going to see a lot more of this. I don't think this is going to be the last announcement that we see about a digital challenger bank coming out of one of the super regionals or one of the majors.
Yeah, the one thing that was a little surprising, and I only know what I've read in the news, but Citizens is calling their Citizens Access, so it's much more tied to their brand, where JP Morgan Chase calls theirs Finn, so it has a completely different name. I think it's a smart idea, but I also think it's smart if you're going to launch your own challenger brand, it ought to really be a challenger, not just feel like an appendage to the main piece, if that's what you're going for.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's some more news as well coming out of Japan this week. The startup up there, Paidy, has got a $55 million Series C for online shopping in Japan without a credit debit card. Now, the reason I wanted to throw this one in, JP, is I think we're going to see a lot more of this. You know, you've got these super wallets in China, Ant Financial, Alipay, Tencent, WeChat. You've got a lot of these mechanisms now, you know, these alternative wallets, Paytm in India and otherwise, Pesa, et cetera, that are really starting to get some strong traction. Because when you're online, of course, the fact that you've got a physical card with a 16-digit number on is really, it doesn't matter, right? You don't need that artifact. So I think we're going to see a lot more interesting things happening, particularly as we start moving towards voice, where these things, the online shopping capability is brought to the fore, not the use of a piece of plastic.
I don't know a ton about the Japanese market. How do you think that market will adopt this kind of program?
Well, you know, you do have some analogies for it in the U.S. You got Suica and Felicia, the two contactless NFC payment ecosystems built, you know, originally around things like the transportation system. And those things are very well accepted there. And people use their phone to pay all the time, tapping with NFC based on these alternatives. And so I think that the opportunity, in terms of legacy behavior, it's not necessarily married to debit and credit. So there are people that have debit and credit cards in Japan, but the transaction activity on them tend to be fairly low. So I think from a transactional perspective online, this is one of the things that Japan needed to solve. People weren't adopting credit card and debit cards at the same rate as we see in other markets. And so you have, there's only really two markets where this is true. You get a lot of people paying for online goods in cash, so cash on delivery. Wouldn't really work in the US, I don't think. But in Germany and in Japan, they're the two markets that have sort of bucked the trend for online payment capability, and where they have cash on delivery for online purchases. So I think that's obviously going to change as cash use declines. But
well, there continues to be so much news in the payments world, and that extends over to the P2P space. Google Google Pay announced that they're now introducing bill sharing and splitting service. So that takes them, as Bank Innovation puts it, a little bit closer towards Venmo and Zelle with some of the new features that they're adding. Meanwhile, Uber announced that they have a partnership with Venmo for their bill splitting service. So some of these ideas that seem maybe a little old for those of us who are really knee-deep in fintech and have been for a long time, it's a reminder that they haven't really reached mainstream acceptance yet, but we're suddenly in a period of acceleration where that's certainly taking place.
And one other falls into the fun news item. We see Canadians are building a cannabis-powered point-of-sale system. Well, it's not technically powered by cannabis, but so with the recent announcement in Canada that there's been the legalization of marijuana, one of the problems you've got is because of the way marijuana was classed as a drug in both the US and in Canada up until very recently, banks haven't wanted to support cannabis businesses in terms of just giving access to bank accounts. So it's been very hard for these startups in the hemp slash weed slash cannabis space to, even if it's medical grade stuff, to get a bank account. So now there's some guys working on technology for enabling point of sales that point of sale access to this industry, and it could be as big as a $4.3 billion industry in Canada alone. So there's some pretty big incentive to set up payments capability and access to take payments in the space. So,
well, certainly the financial services world is a couple of steps behind, and as we talk with our RegTech guest today, we can talk about this, the growth of cannabis as a legal substance in many countries around the world, and it's not developing in sync with the financial services. Although I have to say, when you talked about a cannabis-powered POS solution, I thought you meant meeting Ron Shevlin after a Grateful Dead conference and having him buy you pizza.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, I think...
concert, not conference. Maybe Ron probably does go to Grateful Dead conferences.
Grateful Dead conferences, he probably does. He's got the t-shirt to prove it. But look, I just think the prospects look very high. That's all I'm going to say.
I got
it. All right, let's get into our interview this week. We have two phenomenal guests this week as we talk about RegTech getting serious. The first guest that we'd like to introduce is my good friend, Joanne Barefoot. Joanne's the CEO of Barefoot Innovation Group. She speaks, advises on technology regulation in the U.S. and globally. She's a senior fellow emeritus at Harvard University's JFK School of Government. She's writing a book on innovation. She helped me contribute to Bank 4.0, my latest book on the chapter 2, which is all around RegTech. She hosts her own podcast called Barefoot Innovation. She's the co-founder of Hummingbird FinTech, a new AML RegTech solution, and she sits on the board of the Center for Financial Services Innovation with myself and Jen Tesher and the crowd there. And, of course, she was an advisor to the CFPB here in the United States. So, Joanne, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Thank you. Hi, Brad. Hi, JP.
Hi, welcome.
And our second guest for today is Henry Aslanian. He currently heads up FinTech, RegTech, and Crypto for PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC, in Asia. He's the chairman of the FinTech Association of HK. The abbreviation of that is FTAHK. For obvious reasons, if you sound it out. And lawyer and banker by background, which we'll forgive him for, but he was named by LinkedIn as one of the 2017 global top voices in economy and finance. Henry, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Always a pleasure being here, guys.
Great. So first of all, let me ask you this question. Maybe we'll throw this to you first, Joanne, and then Henry, you jump in. As we talk a lot about fintech, but RegTech, you know, how does that differ from fintech, and why is that difference important?
So people have this crazy idea, Brett, that regulation is really boring, and as a result, it's been sort of passed over by a lot of the innovation underway in the tech world and in fintech. But people are waking up to that. I might have said last time I was on your show, I think what happened is that fintech attracted a lot of new generation tech people into finance, and they started launching their products. And then they looked around at how the regulation was being done, and they said, I can't believe we do it this way. And so we've seen this tremendous flowering of RegTech solutions coming on the heels of FinTech. And the difference is really the technology is mostly all the same technologies driving it, everything from AI and blockchains to voice and mobile and so on. But the use cases are different, and so it's so people use the term to mean both RegTech for regulators, reforming how regulators do what they do, and then also RegTech for the compliance process to break the old binary choice between whether regulation was going to be good but expensive or less expensive but compromised. The digitally native solutions can give you something better, faster, and cheaper all at once.
Okay. Henry?
Absolutely. I think maybe to add to what Joanne mentioned, what's really interesting with RegTech, you know, and there's many ways to define it. I think many of us define it as kind of the use of new technology to solve regulatory compliance burdens, not only more effectively, but also more efficiently. Is that actually what we realized that the way we were dealing with regulations and compliance before often didn't work. I mean, we were talking before about anti-money laundering, AML. I mean, that's a great example where, you know, the UN estimates that there's about $1 to $2 trillion US dollars a year of laundered transactions around the world. And with everything that we're doing right now, we're able to capture less than 1% of that. So it basically means that everything we've been doing or the majority of the work we've been doing in AML hasn't worked. So hopefully we have the chance to do that better and more efficient way using RegTech.
That's a stat we put in the book, actually, Joanne. You remember that?
It is. Henry just used the stat I use all the time, and I'm, you know, it's so stunning. And it tells you that
just in the U.S. alone, $50 billion we spend on AML compliance.
Exactly.
Just in the U.S. So we're talking, must be talking $250, $300 billion globally on AML compliance, at least. Probably $500 billion, and we stop 1%.
That's crazy. So, which means it can't be scaled unless we use a different technology for it.
Absolutely. And you know, the other point that's interesting, Brad, is, you know, often for many financial institutions, it's been kind of existential. You know, for the large big banks, the global banks that we all know about, yes, it's just a cost center. We can talk about how that may potentially move. But, you know, it's estimated that for a large bank with assets between, let's say, up to $10 billion, between $1 to $10 billion, it's around 3% of their costs are compliance related. But actually, when you look for banks that are between less than $100 million in assets, it's often estimated that their compliance costs are around 8 to 9%. Which really shows you how, I mean, the cost of compliance has become really burdened, not only for the large banks, but especially for the rural ones and the regional banks, which people care about a lot.
Mm.
Yeah,
so let me
would add, I just would ahead. Add in the series of papers and books that I'm writing under my Harvard fellowship, I've taken a lot of look at these cost issues, and costs are hard to measure, but those numbers could be on the low side, depending what you include. I mean, it's a tremendous portion of the industry's cost structure.
So then let me, you know, because you're both global, right? Obviously, Joanne, you've done a lot more work in the U.S. space informing this, but, you know, you've worked on the global stage. Hey, Henry, you know, likewise. But in your assessment, when you look at the different markets that are out there, who are, you know, from a jurisdiction perspective, which are the markets that right now you would say really get this problem, are investing in the tech, you know, that are sort of the leaders from a reg tech perspective at the jurisdiction level, at the country level?
I would say that generally speaking, Europe and Asia are very advanced. Singapore has really stood out as a big, fast leader in the space. But the world leader, without a doubt, is the UK and the Financial Conduct Authority.
London City more so than the UK in general, right?
London City for innovation, but the regulatory environment there and the leadership from the regulators themselves is stunning. And I think we're going to circle back to that. I want to share some insights onto what they've been doing because it's really remarkable.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So, Henry, what do you think? What about in Hong Kong? How does that compare with, say, Singapore?
Yeah, it's been very interesting when we look at direct tech, I think, globally. I agree with Joanne's assessment. To be honest, Europe and even in certain parts of the U.S., there's a lot of great innovation. When it comes to direct tech startups, for example, we're actually seeing a lot of companies, institutions, experiment with direct tech in Asia. You know, where we often were referring to this as reverse engineering, where they try it up in Asia, and if it works, they can try to actually, you know, reverse this back in the headquarters in the U.K. and in the U.S. However, one thing I have to say, when it comes to broader rec tech, you know, the what I call the two big solitudes, one of them is China. Obviously, we all know in regular fintech how advanced the China and, you know, the Baidus, the Alibabas, and the Tencent are. One thing we have to potentially look for a couple of years is as these large tech firms have rec tech solutions that the ecosystem locally in China is using them, how they may impact the rest of the global the globe when it comes to rec tech. But I'll give you a good example. Last week, it was a couple of weeks ago, Ant Financial announced that now there was about 29 asset managers that were using one of their solutions. It's not only rec tech, it's more of an optimization tool. But when you look at the data from that, it showed that their operational efficiency was improved by 70% and the cost went down by 50%. So I think we have to watch if one of these large tech firms start offering B2B solutions, including rec tech, and how that may change the game globally, not only in Asia, but also around the world.
But the you saw in Hong Kong was it December last year that the HKMA announced a whole lot of initiatives, but was that, do you think, driven by China and Singapore? Was it driven by the fact that they didn't want to be late to the party, or was it fact that they, you know, did they feel that real innovation was taking place faster in those other markets and in Hong Kong?
Yeah, it's a great question, Brett. What you'll see actually is, I have to say, regulators in Asia broadly have been very impressed with their approach to rec tech and what we call SupTech, supervisor technology. And HKMA in Hong Kong, the SFC, has done actually pretty good job. And for full disclosure, I sit on the SFC's advisory board when it comes to rec tech, but also in the rest of the region as well. I mean, Joanne, you're mentioning the MAS in Singapore. I mean, I'll give you one example. Last year, they made an announcement saying that obviously they were experimenting with SupTech and supervisor technology and using this technology for them as a regulator, for example, and trying to deal with the 3,000 suspicious transaction reports that are coming out every month. But what was really interesting, they made an announcement saying that if, as a regulator, they ask a bank for a certain set of data, and it just happens that the regulator asks for that data again, then actually as a financial institution, you have the right to politely decline to give it to them. This was actually announced last year, so we have to see how it's going to be implemented. But it really shows you how forward-looking some of the regulators in Asia are when it comes to broader rec tech, including SupTech.
Yeah, that's such a great example. Brett, I would add that the U.S. is not in the forefront. We have a lot of great reg tech firms here. Our regulatory environment in the U.S. has been a little slower to adopt it. I think it's partly because we have so many agencies here. I was deputy controller of the currency myself. We have a very fragmented federal agency structure plus our 50 states. But it is all moving, and the CFPB, or as we now are calling it, the BCFP, has announced that they're going to do a sandbox and maybe announcing it as early as next week. And it might have a RegTech component in it. So there's definitely discussion underway in the U.S. as well, but less concrete progress so far.
Well, I mean, there are two important moving parts here. Part of it is a technology arms race. And as we started talking about anti-money laundering, Joanne, you have noted in the past that we're least effective at the largest and most sophisticated transnational criminals, right? They're the ones that can find the loopholes and the workarounds of the systems that we have today. So we need better and more sophisticated systems. But you also just hinted at what I think is one of the other big things, and that is just kind of the culture and the approach that they're taking. So what has to happen for regulators to move to more of a RegTech environment, and maybe particularly around what you just mentioned around the sandboxes? Where do they get started? How do they encourage innovation? And what are the best practices you've seen so far from those that are doing it well?
I think that the secret to it, again, speaking as a former bank regulator myself, is for the regulators culturally, as you say, to get comfortable with the idea that they're going to need to move forward without knowing exactly what they're going to do. This does not come naturally to regulators. You know, we're
right.
used to
nor
having
bankers.
Everything. Nor bankers, exactly. But it's the nature of the situation we're in that if you stand still until you think something is going to be more clear, it's just going to get farther away from you and the risks are going to be rising and the opportunities are going to be lost. So I think that this shift is happening at regulators all over the world, a willingness to start to be experimental and to try things. And I mentioned the Financial Conduct Authority's leadership in this. They did a stunning experiment last fall on machine executable regulation, the notion of issuing some regulations in the form of computer code rather than words or in addition to words. And they ran a test. They brought in an eclectic group of people, industry, tech firms and coders, academics and so on. They spent 2 weeks in what they call a tech sprint, which is a hackathon, where they worked on the problem of taking, they chose one line of regulatory guidance having to do with reporting requirements for a retail loan, and they worked on translating the syntax of the law and regulation into the syntax of computer code. And there's a video online of this. They, at the end of the 2 weeks, on the last day, they successfully executed this against a set of test data, got a correct report back, and then changed the requirement and got a corrected report back in 10 seconds. And it's a process that would take 2 years the old-fashioned way. So this is a breakthrough, completely different thinking and being driven by the regulators themselves, but with collaboration from the industry. The other thing I'll say is they held another tech sprint in May on AML, and other regulators, to your point, JP, came from all over the world, including we had 6 regulatory agencies from the United States there learning from the FCA's leadership. You know, how do you run a hackathon, how do you start to try a new regulatory process.
So your next regulator may be a robot.
There we go.
This is a key point, isn't it, that the inevitability of this is that regulation in real time has to be in computer code. So then what role does legislation play? Because it's not legal code anymore, it's becoming real-time responsive computer code. So this changes the whole linkage between law and regulation, doesn't it?
If you're asking me, yes. We've got a long journey ahead. This is such a complex ecosystem, which is why, back to the point you started with about the banks starting to launch their digital challenger banks. That's what the regulators have to do. They have to start to create alternative reg tech driven channels to do things differently and experiment and learn and let people opt into that rather than trying to re-engineer it all from the top down, because we don't even know yet how to do all this, not to mention have the political will to do it. But that's the direction we're going to go in, and it's going to save money. In the United States, it could be the savior of the community banks, for example, the small banks that are struggling under the crushing burden that Henri talked about in terms of the percentage of their compliance costs in their operating costs.
Absolutely. But we're also seeing progress as well, Joanne. I mean, I think many people don't realize that a lot of regulators have many now data scientists on board. I was reading recently that the SEC has around 100 data scientists working on these issues. And the other thing we should never forget is, unlike banks, regulators don't necessarily compete with each other, at least at the international level. So I think it could be a great area to see some potential collaboration and best practice sharing, which is great that we're already seeing in the market. And hopefully we'll see even more over the months and years to come.
Great. Well, listen, guys, we do have to go to a break right now. It's that time. So before we go to break, I just wanted to remind you guys that this show is brought to you by The Financial Revolutionist, which has been named one of the best tech newsletters by Business Insider. It's written each week by co-founder Greg Schoenberg. It's been referred to as the FinTech newsletter that's not just about FinTech. That's because in addition to FinTech, it touches on a wide range of financial innovation topics, politics, healthcare, changing nature of the workforce, AI impact, history, pop culture, etc. You can check it out and subscribe at www.thefr.com. That stands for thefinancialrevolutionist.com. But it's time to take a short break, and we'll be right back talking more about RegTech, SupTech, and where this is all going to take us. Right back with Breaking Banks. Some more of that in a moment.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Now, before we get back to talking about FinTech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and FinTech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. The second half of today's show is sponsored by Medici. They've partnered with FedFiz, the bank data specialist, to create a new solution called the FI Data Pack, and it provides proprietary ratings, financial metrics, and context for every bank and credit union in the U.S. Now, this can empower your sales and market team to focus on identifying the perfect financial institutions for your next sale. You can use code PROVOKE to receive a discount at gomedici.com/breakingbanks. Well, we have been talking with Joanne Barefoot and Henri Arslanian, our RegTech specialists, and maybe we'll focus on the tech side of that now. So, and Joanne, I'll start with you. What kind of technology skills do we need to have? We were talking before the break about the evolution of the regulatory agencies and the regulators themselves. What kind of new skills are we going to need as we think about things like machine learning and artificial intelligence becoming day-to-day tools in regulation and in regulators?
Yeah. So the regulators have their work cut out for sure. They don't currently have the right skill sets, broadly speaking, and there are certainly exceptions developing. But they are going to need data scientists. They're going to need people who understand machine learning and AI and distributed ledger technologies. They're going to need to try to recruit these. And, of course, they have trouble attracting people both because they don't have the lucrative pay scales, and also, as I said at the beginning, people have this incorrect idea that these are boring problems. My experience is that when you put tech people together with these regulatory challenges, and AML is a great example in our Hummingbird RegTech, you know, these are fascinating problems and important problems. Fighting financial crime, as we said at the beginning, is really important. But so they need to attract them in, and then even more than that, they're going to have to build different ways of collaborating. The UK Financial Conduct Authority RegTech group has 7 people in it, and they have hundreds of people helping them, actively helping them because the industry is bringing its data scientists and its AI experts to the table to start to talk about how can we really redesign some of this regulation and the compliance process. And it's really about bringing people together. And
they got to speak the same language.
They do.
Yeah, maybe to add on what Joanne mentioned, I think from a skill set perspective, that's not only at the regulator perspective, but also at the people on the ground. You know, the example I often give is lawyers. You know, there's many you know, research out there that says that up to 25 to 40% of legal jobs potentially may disappear because of the broader, law tech movement going on. You know, for example, there's only in the U.S., there's about 1.3 million licensed lawyers. And just to put that in perspective, there are more lawyers in America than computer programmers and software developers combined. And what we are seeing actually in practice is, in order to change that, we need to actually change the skill sets that we're providing lawyers with and people in law schools. You know, I often say that, one of my TEDx talks is exactly on this topic, just got released a couple of weeks ago, that we really need to change how we training the next generation of lawyers, and hopefully we'll one day see a master's in the legal coding or a legal data scientist be really more mainstream than what it is today.
Very interesting. Yeah, so it's this pretty big skill gap opening up right now, right? Because regulators haven't exactly been known as technology centers, historically, have they?
Definitely not. I think one of the ideas that's got power here is, and we've been advocating it at Hummingbird, is moving toward an open source regulatory framework that might begin to move us onto platforms where the regulators essentially are putting out the standards for what it takes to meet their requirements for auditability and fairness and all of it, and then start to let the rest of the world innovate the way people write apps for the iPhone, and through that to develop rapid learning, where instead of having the rigid regulatory processes we have today that are so formal and slow and back and forth, and they're built for good reason to be slow and careful. I'm a former bank regulator. I really empathize with the regulator situation, but we're going to have to figure out how to speed it up and still have appropriate oversight. And I think part of it is just knocking down the walls and letting people start to collaborate in more platform environments with more open standards that just make it easier to share and to learn from each other.
That's a really big change, because that's not how regulators have worked historically. It's just mind-blowing in that respect. So, Henri, let me ask you, throw this back at you. You travel the world a lot, but in terms of the startups in the space, tell us about some of the more interesting startups that are out there, the biggest startups in the space, and what they're doing, and then what are some of the challenges they have in practice?
Absolutely. Maybe just on Joanne's point, there's obviously a lot of talk now how regulators can deal with it. One of them, actually, there's a paper just got released by the Milken Institute on actually how can regulators potentially deal with this. Actually, a document Joanne and I both contributed to that just got published actually yesterday. But to bring it back to your point, Ben, on what we are seeing with RegTech startups in practice, well, I think anybody, we all know, selling B2B fintech inside a financial institution is very difficult. When it comes to RegTech, it's probably even more difficult. I mean, let's think about the sales cycles are probably even longer. The downside of getting it wrong is actually way, 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 way bigger as well. But and also, there's a lot of practical difficulties as well. One of them we've seen with RegTech in particular in practice has been the need of an internal champion. Whereas I think the entire financial services ecosystem went through the learning curve of fintech over the last 3-4 years, when it comes to RegTech, as Joanne was mentioning at the beginning, we're still at the early, the last 1 or 2 years has been where we've seen a push, but the education levels are not there often many financial institutions, and that is acting as kind of a barrier to entry. So unless we're seeing startups have a very strong internal champion, like I often say, somebody's willing to put his personal career on the line to bring a new RegTech solution in, it's actually quite difficult in practice. Not to mention, obviously, fundraising. I think for a lot of investors who are looking for a sector where they can hit the hockey stick quickly, RegTech is obviously not one. RegTech is very sticky. It's a very great annuity business. Once you close a deal, it's there. But it takes obviously longer sales cycles than a normal B2C startup, for example.
So listen, maybe I'll throw this back to both of you, not sure who you want us to take this first. But you know, one of the things that we've started to understand as we've seen the mobile come into play around the world, certainly we've had the fastest ever change in financial inclusion happen as a result of mobile. But that also, you know, that is also a little bit tied to identity and how regulators think about identity, KYC, and so forth. If you look at the US, with 20% of households that are, you know, underbanked or unbanked in the US, you could argue that's primarily as a result of the fact that the documentary requirements to get into the banking system are now excluding people. So when we start looking at some of these new models emerging in other markets around blockchain and stuff like that, you see these new models like zero proof identity concepts and stuff like that. What do you guys see? Where do you see a regulation taking us in respect to identity and how that ties in with financial inclusion?
I'm happy to jump in on that. So this is one of the biggest areas for sure. As you say, there's globally a tremendous problem of exclusion of people who can't identify themselves. And digitization of life and of finance can solve that for us. If you look at a really dramatic example, you can see the India Aadhaar project in the India stack, where they've gotten biometric identity on almost everyone in India, 1.2 billion people, I think. And it's opened the door so that people can prove who they are, men, women, and children. It's been incredibly powerful as an inclusive opportunity for women who previously might have just not had the credentials in the household at all. And even in the economies like the U.S., where we feel like we've had pretty good identity systems through social security numbers and so on. You know, today our social security numbers are for sale on the dark web, and so is our address.
Yeah, they're not protected. You can't secure them anymore.
You can't secure them anymore. They're everywhere. So we're going to all have to go to digital identity. It's going to unlock an incredible amount of access throughout the developing world, and it's also going to improve security for everybody else. It's a huge, huge area. And then it's specifically in anti-money laundering. There's a lot of people working on the know your customer problem globally.
Absolutely, Joanna. Maybe to, you know, give a bit of perspective, this is one area I was mentioning at the beginning where we may see emerging markets really take the lead. I mean, coming back to China, I mean, some of the technology you see when it comes to facial recognition in China is absolutely incredible. And you know,
right, they can find any one of the 1.4 billion people in 3 seconds, apparently, right?
Here you go. So, I mean, it makes the banking experience of onboarding to going to teller a bit of a joke compared to that. But also it goes beyond that as well. You know, you're mentioning 20% of households in the U.S. don't have a bank. You know, I always give the other example, which is 80% of Americans don't have access to basic legal services. So even before identity, like we have, you know, we're seeing solutions now, chatbots, for example, that provide basic legal service. You know, let's say you're a single mom and you want to know what are some of the government benefits that are available to you. And, you know, these services, you shouldn't go to a lawyer. It should be very easily accessible from that perspective. But, you know, especially when it comes to KYC, what has been very interesting for us in practice has been, you know, I remember I was introducing a lot of KYC vendors to banks about a year or a year and a half ago. And obviously, we all know the challenges with that. What really amazed me is with the crypto and ICO boom that took place. So many of these KYC vendors made a pivot and started focusing a lot on the crypto space. And what's remarkable for me right now, where you know the deals are faster, you can close deals, there's not the long sell cycles. And actually, if I look at an average ICO right now in the market, they probably have better, easier, and faster KYC than actually a lot of the banks have, just because they're able to use the latest RegTech technology. So it's always funny how the world evolves from a macro perspective, depending on the big trends going on.
Yeah, it's also true of fintechs. They're blazing the trail on using RegTech just because they have better data, clean new systems, and openness to innovation, and are comfortable with iterative change. You know, I think we're going to move away from the compliance design of the past, which has been centralized IT systems that are very rigid, combined with little one-off compliance databases all over the place that don't connect it properly to anything. We're going to move all that onto platforms that are going to be modular, and the tools are going to update continuously and improve continuously. It's a very different model, but it is so much, it's so superior that I think we're going to struggle our way to it.
Well, as the tools get updated, we need to update the regulations themselves too, right? You've talked about, as one example, CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act, written in, 1977? We didn't even have mobile phones.
When Star Wars came out.
Right.
The first Star Wars.
Right.
And when banks didn't, we had no interstate banking either.
Well, and you've talked about this, Joanne, that the line of thinking then was, and a part of CRA is about inclusion, which we were just talking about. So inclusion meant you need to have a branch in my neighborhood. But inclusion doesn't mean that in most of the world now. How are we going to update the actual regulations, and are we prepared to do that in Congress?
The example that I'm using lately is the Truth in Lending Act, because it turned 50 at the end of May. So it's a half century old. CRA isn't much younger.
Don't pick on 50-year-olds.
Yeah, I'm older than you, so let's not go there. Sure. But the same with the Bank Secrecy Act. I think it's 48. You know, so these are half century old laws. It's not anybody's fault, but they were written in a world of analog technology for systems that were designed on paper, right? And maybe we've added automation to them through the years. They're still built that way. We have to switch over to digitally native design of regulation. And I am very optimistic that both legislators and regulators are seeing this increasingly. It's not an easy shift for them. But again, I think part of the key to it is to not force change on the entire system in terms of regulatory change, as much as in some areas to pick off some, innovate the way the private sector does. Pick some areas and say, we're going to start doing this differently. If you want to, bank, for example, we can plug you in with an API. We'll be able to see your data in real time, all of it, not periodic reports, not little samples, and we'll set some standards for monitoring it that you'll understand. And if you want to do that, we'll unburden you in the traditional regulatory activities that are assessing the quality of your compliance program and your controls, which are very, very burdensome and which don't necessarily produce the outcomes we want. We need to shift toward outcomes-based regulation and compliance by asking ourselves, what do we really want? CRA is a great example. It is being revisited for sure. The administration is working on it. There's a lot of interest in Congress if statutory change is needed. And people are realizing that we're going to need to build fintech, really reward the industry for offering fintech solutions that are going to serve low and moderate income people better than their traditional branches have in many cases. We see that all over the world in people getting access through their phone.
You'd think that would be a big driver for regulators to get 100% financial inclusion and get people financially healthy. But in practice, it's not the key driver, is it? I guess we tend to be very market risk focused, but... Henry, what about globally in respect to what else is happening in the space?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe I think I agree with Joanne as well. There's a lot of great stuff going on globally. I mean, we can see what the examples with India and Aadhaar, or even some of the other onboarding options we're seeing in China. But I think what's really important when it comes to regulations often is when there's new regulatory initiatives, often you'll see that being a catalyst for the rest of the ecosystem. I mean, I'll give you a very good example of what's happening right now in Hong Kong, where there's a very big new kind of guidance that came out for virtual banks, which is basically digital banks. And really, you're seeing the momentum pick up right now with RegTech providers really back and trying to where we can build these new digital banks really from the ground up without the legacy systems that you're mentioning, John. And really,
hey, so Henry, just so because, you know, we got a lot of listeners on the AM band, you know, where we syndicate here in the US and so forth, and they won't be familiar with ADAR. So can you explain what the ADAR card is?
Absolutely. Well, ADAR, you know, as obviously India being a country with more than 1 billion people, it's been the lack of proper identification has been a problem for a long time. And what there was a great initiative which is called India Stack, which basically came up with a mechanism with the goal of actually being able to identify every single citizen. And it's been a great success with more than a billion people who are identified not only with the biometrics, with their iris scanned and their fingerprints, but basically now being able to be connected to and identified, compared to the old way, which was paper cards and other ways. So really brought India, in many ways, was kind of the leader when it comes to doing it, not only at the small scale, but really at the country level, which is quite impressive.
Yeah, and that includes not just access to banking, which in one foul swoop, they introduced 800 million people into the banking system because, you know, when you got an ADAR card, you got access to a basic value store, but also medical services, taxation, government services, a whole range of stuff, right? Yeah.
Very cool. If I could just add, that's one reason why central banks all over the world are, as are some of the global NGOs like the World Bank and the Gates Foundation and the Intermediary Network, they're prioritizing financial inclusion and also to some extent RegTech, because they're looking at financial inclusion as an engine of economic growth. And it does become part of a competitive strategy, both to build your economy and also to create a regulatory environment that is going to attract talent and capital. Mm. As well.
So talking about that, attracting talent, you know, one of the things that obviously banks are starting to compete heavily for and finding it a challenge to get is people in the machine learning, artificial intelligence space. So, you know, where do you see AI's role in the regulatory space to start with? Maybe and also you know, we've got to talk, Henry, about crypto and blockchain as well, but in terms of sort of these core skill sets, maybe let's start with you, Henry. Where do you see all that stuff fitting in regulation?
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be playing a massive role when we look at the broader AI space when it comes to RegTech. Actually, my next book coming out next year is going to talk a lot about these topics. What you'll see in many ways,
have you got a title yet?
Yeah, we're finalizing right now, so I'll probably announce it over the coming weeks.
All right, well, we'll have you back on once it's ready.
I would love to. But, you know, really, we're seeing a lot of, I think it's not only a question of the talent, but also the industry being ready. I mean, again, let me bring it back to the legal example, which I find is fascinating. What we found in many cases, in, let's say, a lawyer's time, some studies even would say that up to one-third of a lawyer's time is often spent doing research, which right now there's a lot of tools for doing legal research, which can empower these lawyers at doing their job more effectively, more efficiently, and at the end of the day, reducing the cost and for the end user and enabling more better access to legal systems. But when it comes to broader the talent gap that we're seeing in the broader rec space and the legal space, there's definitely a lot of work to be done there. But I have to say, I'm quite happy to see some of the initiatives going on around the world, not only at the academic level, but also some of the industries coming together from that perspective, trying to fill this gap, which is very exciting.
So, Joanne, what are your thoughts? Because we've got just about a minute before we have to start the close.
So AI and machine learning are definitely the driver, combined with the proliferation of data. They're going to be the transformative thing. I've started evaluating conferences, and including the ones I host myself, on whether I have to declare an acronym-free zone because the room is full of regulatory people and tech people, RegTech. If you can get them both together and make them talk the each other's languages and educate them, things start to happen fast. So that's the key, is that's how we're going to attract the AI people into the regulatory space, is to let them know how important are the problems that we're solving, and they'll come.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, guys, it's been fantastic to have you guys on the show. We could talk about this area. You know, we didn't even get into supervisory tech and you know, a lot of that stuff. The concept that maybe jurisdictions might start competing for customers as well as banks and fintechs to license. There's a whole lot of stuff. Data residency, data privacy. Yeah, well, there's a whole lot of stuff we could have got into. But thank you, John Barefoot and Henri Aslanian, for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
Thanks for having us.
It was a pleasure.
It's been fun.
Yeah, we'll get you guys back on as well. And we say this after every show, but if you like Breaking Banks, if you like the show today, don't forget, give us a 5-star rating. In fact, go to iTunes right now if that's where you downloaded us. I'll wait. Well, actually, no, I've got to finish the show off. But go wherever you get the show. Tweet it out on Twitter. You can do at Breaking Banks 1, at Brett King. JP, what's your Twitter handle again?
I'm on Twitter at JP Nichols, no H.
We've been getting such great feedback on the show lately. It really helps us to sort of get others to find the show. And if you can share your reviews on your favorite podcast platform, it would be really helpful.
You know, this is our 246th show. So in just a few weeks' time, it'll be our 250th episode. And you can listen to all of them, plus episodes from FinTech 5 with Jason Henricks, my own Serial Entrepreneur podcast, and our Asia Pacific version of Breaking Banks with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. And, you know, last thing, if you are in the UK, please go to amazon.co.uk and pre-order Bank 4.0. That's Brett's latest book in the Bank series that he started back in 2009, and I'm sure it will be a bestseller list. Your pre-order will help get us there. You'll recognize a lot of names in the book, guests of the show, and members of the so-called fintech mafia, although I love, as Dave Grabino explains it, there is no such thing as the fintech mafia, as he's wearing his fintech mafia t-shirt. Absolutely. But check it out and pre-order Bank 4.0 at amazon.co.uk.
Jim Marouse is in the book too. You see, I got it right again.
All right. Jim will be happy.
All right, guys. Well, that's another Breaking Banks. Thanks again for joining us. We love to have you participate and listen. Thanks to Joanne and Henry, and thanks to JP for co-hosting. We'll be back next week with another episode of Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.